Okay, ready to talk about this stuff? Keep it conversational. I've got a framework I want to present. It won't take too long. Just what I think are, for me, three convenient ways to conceptualize what we're talking about with biohacking. Biohacking can mean lots of things to people. The human in the street will think of the worst case scenario, something that they downloaded into their thinking from a TV series or a movie, and that's probably beyond the reach of most kids in their basements today to do striking and frightening things. So if we had done something like that in the late 70s, early 80s about computer hacking, I would have said the same thing. That's probably not something that's going to happen soon. You would have had to wait a couple of decades for the evolution of the technology and the dissemination of it and distribution to make it cheap, widely available. So in the 70s and 80s, what were called hackers in the late 70s, early 80s, were generally people who had to be at the top of the game and really understood computer science and knew what it was about and found it a flexible and malleable and open and exciting and playful kind of field for their meditation, for their thinking, for their exploration, and to create new things. Whereas a couple decades later, as you know, the word hacker meant some miscreant, some Romanian, some bad actor owned by a foreign state, not by our own state, in which case it's defense and patriotism. Stuxnet is defense and patriotism. The way I'm going to talk about biohacking is similar to the way it was in the 70s and 80s, because that's kind of where I think it is now. It's a moving target. People are evolving new ways of doing it. But biology is the new way to go. There are markers in which you can discern what's likely to be emergent in the future. My own three favorite ones are I look at what kids are playing with. For example, that table full of Legos out there. When Mindstorms first came out, Seymour Papert developed putting CPU and Legos together. You knew that robots were one of the waves of the future. When children play with stuff, it's inevitable that it's going to show up. If you go down to the museum downtown Milwaukee and read lists of stuff that they sell, alien life forms, thought reactors, space debris, and you look at the kinds of stuff they sell, then you know the next generation. Society has filtered these concepts into the toy or play space, and playing and toys are a good place for a society that begins to socialize its members and future adult members to learn how to do the kinds of flexible things that are going to be needed in the future. The other is to look, of course, at another is to look at vice industries. I won't dwell on that, but you know that the first place stuff goes is porn. You know, the first books, Incunabula, were what we would call porn. The first DVD, what did we call them? Video cassette recorders. Remember those? You probably, some of you are too young to remember them. It used to be a big boxy thing. You had to hook up to your TV, and you got another little boxy thing about the size of what we used to call a book. And then that went in there. And then what you think of as digital imagery, but it wasn't, would then play across the screen. The reason we had those in our homes was because people wanted to watch porn. In the 60s, I Am Curious Yellow, I Am Curious Blue, Deep Throat. Any of you remember that? Before you knew Deep Throat was the name of an FBI informant for Bob Woodward. Those movies began to play at the major movie theaters, in the neighborhood. And then I have to explain that. I can't believe how fast things move. When I was a kid, we used to have what we called a neighborhood movie theater. And it would play a movie or two. And sometimes you'd go for a double feature. And the movie would play downtown first, and then it would go out to the boonies instead of opening at what multiplexes, which we didn't have then. And so Deep Throat and movies like it began in the late 60s suddenly to show up in downtown Wilmette, I remember. And it was a shock. And once people could see mainstream porn, they wanted to take it home. And that's what fuel injected the video cassette recorder industry. So I'm just saying, since that's where the money goes first, because that's what humans love to do, then you look at the research and development in that area to see what's coming next. So one of the best interviews I did early on years ago was with a guy, Seth Warshawski. He ran a thing called clublove.com. It's one of the first big porn sites. He's way ahead of the curve, and he was already investing in platforms and dissemination, and realized early on the content was going to become iterative and just easily replicated. You could buy a turnkey porn site with 50,000 images and go into business. The bulletin boards were already there. So you look to those industries, gambling as well, not just sex, gambling, other vices where people funnel millions of dollars to see what's coming next. And the third, an obvious place and harder to get at but much more rewarding when you can, is what kind of research is being done by the military and intelligence community? Because since World War II, much of the research in the social sciences as well as the sciences has been at the least dual use, which means it's funded simultaneously for legitimate purposes that can be described in a way that out here society recognizes and likes to appropriate, but also has a subterranean purpose for which it is really being developed inside. So if you can get a hold of what kind of dark projects or black projects, and there are signals or markers that tell you what's probably being developed, including silence, vast silence around an area, then you have a clue what's coming next. In this area, biohacking, I talked to a guy named Jonathan Marino. He wrote a book called Mind Wars, which is still worth reading. Marino's dad was CIA. Marino's worked inside and outside the fence, as well as being head of a bioethics department, I believe, at the University of Virginia. And he wanted to write a book about the neurological, the neuroscientific kinds of research that were being done with military applications. And he told me that it was harder than working on the Manhattan Project would have been in the 40s. People just clammed up. And this is a guy with good reputation. And my point in reviewing his book was that he kept saying, really, I'm a smart guy, I'm an honest guy. Successfully, ridicule is used to discredit people who want to investigate things that aren't wanted to be investigated. And he had to keep inserting, I'm legitimate, I'm credentialed, I'm bona fide, in order to justify an interest in even something like mind wars. He's talking about biological weaponry, he's talking about the manipulation of memory, he's talking about all sorts of things that might come under the title of biohacking, and which was done inside. In exactly the same way and in parallel, the computing science was developed from the 40s on, as you probably know, inside first. So I used to love when early hackers, young kids, would talk in the 70s and 80s, 90s, really, about how they had this free space, this great new space that had come along called cyberspace. It had been developed by the military-industrial complex from the beginning. And continues to be developed and monitored by the same. So biohacking is kind of where computer hacking was then. Now we have script kiddies in computer hacking. You can download modules, you can press a button and you know, click, and bingo, you can send a payload that's more powerful than anybody could get their hands on way back then. This is where biological hacking may go as well. We knew things were starting to turn. Another marker is, what are the markers of what a society is looking forward to? Early 2000s, MIT had a new president, and she had a background PhD experience in biology. MIT is an engineering school. Well, it was no longer an engineering school only. It was a bioengineering school. And if you look at a speech she gave, which is on the internet in 2004, you'll see that she said the only way to educate anybody these days going forward is in a cross-disciplinary way. We have to be able to go across boundaries into other disciplines, some of which are now emerging with names that literally didn't exist 10 and 20 years ago, in order to be considered an educated person. That sounds to someone who hasn't gotten there yet, who thinks there are subjects, and you get a degree in that subject, and then you're a practitioner of that subject, that is so old school. It just doesn't work anymore. Again, a sign of the times. My own kid, when he went to Northwestern, he's going to be 40 next month, so this was 20 years ago. When he graduated, they had people who majored in history and people who majored in this and that. And then they said, and we have one ad hoc major. And everybody laughed because that's what new emergent realities do to people who haven't got a clue yet that they are the sign of the future. They laughed at his ad hoc major because it made it sound like it was trivial. What in fact he had done is go to the liberal arts faculty and say, what I want to study doesn't have a subject name here, can I create it? And he created symbolic systems studies in which he took courses from math, courses from artificial intelligence, computer science, cognitive psychology, about five different domains, and took courses from each one that existed and called it symbolic systems studies. And they called it an ad hoc major. They didn't know that that was the future. In other words, for you, to be educated means to know how to know, to know how to learn, to know how to use other disciplines and integrate them and articulate the synthesis of that cross-disciplinary travel. Well, that's what she said, this new president of MIT in 2004, was going to be necessary going forward, as well as the future is biology. And so when Bill Gates said a couple of months ago in a Wired interview, something as obvious as that, he said, if I were studying over again today, I would not be in computing. I would be in biology. Because computing, the wave he caught early on in the 80s, has crested. It's a more mature industry. There's a lot of added on, but there's probably not going to be that transformational engine like it was once that's coming from biology. So it's talking about that kind of thing, importing the methodologies and the attributes and the attitudes of hackers to experimentation, exploration, and biological science, and increasingly the ability to do that ad hoc, at home, in your garage, the way Jobs and Wozniak at one time built that little Apple to supplant the Sinclair and create an entire industry called the personal computer. We're going to have the personal biological manipulated module, but it'll have a clever name like that, like BioFuts or something. And everybody's going to buy one, it'll be cute, and there'll be a Steve Jobs to replace Steve Jobs, except it'll be in biology. I have a story about that. I'm not going to flog these. I start writing fiction 8-9 years ago when a guy at the NSA said to me, you know, you can't discuss any of the things we talk about with you unless you start writing fiction. So I've published about 35 stories since then. Before that, I wrote nonfiction. This was about computing and its impacts on social and cultural stuff. And there's a story in here about Gibby the Sit-Down King, who was nominated for a prize. I love that story. Gibby is a vast, Brobdingnagian hacker. All anybody sees from the rear is a little crack and jeans, riding low, and his chair, because that's where he sits. And he created Alter Genies in the story. Alter Genies was an open source platform to allow people to develop every sexual scenario imaginable, because he assumed that the population like him was sexually obsessed and spent a lot of time looking at porn. Then he and his industry would create the scenarios to interact with all five senses with the way people altered themselves to be able to get off on a new kind of higher sexual scenario. It's a wonderful story, literary, but pseudo-pornographic. That's in there, and it's also on the web. You can find all the stuff I write on the web for, as you know, free. Just share that. Okay. Go ahead. Just take my card and Google me and go to my website. It's all there. What the hell? Give it away. I'm past worrying about that stuff. So, the essence of hacking. Guy named Simple Nomad. You guys know Simple Nomad? Anybody? I was talking to Bruce Potter, Shmukan, and he said this to him in a conversation in a hotel bar. He said, for the system to work, and he meant the hacking system, it must never grow up and it should make us smile. That's hacking. It requires a kind of youthful playfulness. The same kind of thing that caused Sony engineers, when they did the first PlayStation, you know, they put it on the floor and they invited all these 10 and 12-year-olds in to play with it. And then the scientists who invented it sat behind one-way glass and observed them, because the children, in their infinite playfulness, immediately began inventing new uses for the PlayStation that the inventors themselves had never conceptualized. So playfulness, a willingness to... Well, what happens if we do this? Well, how about this? Boom, the garage goes up, whatever. You have to take risks in order to play hard. But that's one of the signs of hacking. And it should make us smile. It's got a humorous, a Loki-like approach to life, a trickster approach. It's clever. It's cute. It makes you smile. Like one of the first DEF CONs I went to way back when there were just a few hundred people at the Monte Carlo Hotel. And they had taken over the security networks from the people in the hotel. And there were two towers, and they told all the people in security in the left tower that there was a crisis in the right tower, and they told all the people in the right tower there was a crisis in the left. And then they sat in the lobby and laughed and laughed and laughed while they watched all the phalanxes of people cross paths as they went from left to right and right to left. Or changing the EEPROMs on the chips, managed the elevators so that every elevator went to 6, and only to 6. It was funny. Yes, some adult, some spoil sport said, you know, if there was a fire, that could be a problem. Oh, duh. It's fun. But it has to have that quality. Or you can think of the way, what's his name, E.O. Wilson, who wrote Consilience. He said, what are the characteristics of all good scientists? They are passion, obsessiveness, and daring. passion, obsessiveness, and daring. I personally do not know anybody who is interesting who is not obsessive compulsive. It's including myself. It's just the way it is, because you can't learn enough about anything unless you stay up all night, drink Jolt, drink caffeine, whatever. I remember going to one of those damn cons, Pump Con, I think it was, and they said, have a cup of coffee. And I had it, and I almost literally died of a heart attack. So what the hell? Well, we used Aqua Joe, caffeinated water, and then we poured it back through the filter 13 times. I drank 2 inches. And it was like that thing they used to show us in health in eighth grade to get you scared of smoking. What happened to a rabbit if you put it straight in his heart? Nicotine, and the rabbit's heart went crazy. That's the way it fell. So some of you probably know, unless you stay up late, have nothing else to compel you to turn your attention away from what you're obsessed with. Not just scientists, but real hackers. You have to pursue it until it doesn't want to quit, and then be daring. Or, last thing like this, a friend of mine is an NSA guy, and he said, you know, this was a few years ago, he said, people are asking all the wrong questions. The questions they should be asking are, how do you live vibrantly? How do you free your mind? And how do you live in a world without walls? Because the world in which they existed has no walls, and it has no boundaries. Now, that's the world in which we live also. The difference is we don't all know it. And some of the workshops I've done make people anxious when you keep giving the details that show that. I remember one guy who raised his hand. He said, you're making me feel helpless. And I said, terrific, because you're at -1. When you came in here, you were at -2. You were helpless, and you didn't know it. Now you're helpless and aware of it, and you want to take it one more notch to 0, which is what, he said. I said, doing something about it, taking responsibility for moving forward into the future instead of bewailing the fact that time moves on like a river and you can't stand at the bank because you're in the river. So, Matt Blaze, computer scientist, said the weakest link in a security chain is the definition of the problem. And the real definition of the problem is frequently not the definition that people work with. Well, we can port that insight to identity. The weakest link in who we think we are and what we think it means to be human is our definition of our own identity and humanity. And the real definition of who we are is not the one that we customarily work with. That's what biohacking is attacking head on. In other words, it's altering who it is we think we are. Let's take a simple example. Versed. You familiar with Versed? No, you're a young crowd. Okay, who's had a colonoscopy? One old guy. All right, not many. Well, you get a colonoscopy, you want to kind of stay awake, you know. I mean, it's interesting, you watch the screen, you take a trip down your tube, and you watch what's happening. What was that? Monster. Lives in there. It's interesting. But a lot of people don't want to know afterward. They give them Versed. It shuts them down. They feel nothing. And my wife used to work for a surgical center, and she would hear the doctor, you know, you should choose a job that you love. Well, this doctor loved hurting people, and he would often start the colonoscopy before the stuff took hold. And my wife would hear through the wall, hear the people crying, ow, 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 you know, normal response to a doctor by a patient. And then they would come out 2 hours later, and she would say, how was your procedure? And they would say, it was fine. I didn't feel a thing. Well, they didn't remember feeling a thing, because what Versed does is flood the brain with short-term memory eraser. You don't remember short-term what happened to you. A friend of mine who does interrogation said, you know, there'd be a lot more people whining about torture if they remembered that they went through it. In other words, there are ways to eliminate the memory of what immediately preceded the administration of the drug. This is a trivial and simple example, but the alteration of memory, the creation of memory, Blade Runner style. Remember? Memories. You're talking about memories. That's why that's such a stroke of genius. On a top level, we've been doing this for decades. We call it public relations and advertising. We also call it management of perception. We create memories which then link a community in a false understanding of its own history and believes that this is what has been true. So at top level, it's done with ideation, image, and language. At the biological level, it can be done chemically. So we now know there are proteins that encode for long-term memory, and there are proteins that encode for short-term memory. And we know we can eliminate one or the other in rats. Rats are pretty close to humans in a lot of ways, morally superior, but other than that, the difference is they don't do the stuff we do, type of animals.
Well, electricity does a pretty good job of doing superior.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, I have a sister-in-law that's had over 150 shock therapy treatments. It's very effective. Electricity will do it, but it's kind of indiscriminate. What we want to do is target particular memories so that we can identify where a memory is encoded and how to get rid of it.
Is there something inherently biological without the administration of any external chemical that, at least I know within females, that when they give birth, when they are going through the actual active labor, there's something that the body produces that makes you forget how bad that hurt.
That's right. You're absolutely right. And what we're talking about is erasing, as in many cases has already been erased, any meaningful distinction between artificial and natural. Those are two terms like foreign and domestic in the computer world, security world, that literally no longer have any meaning because the boundaries have literally disappeared. So through evolution, when you have a crisis or a trauma, what it does is flood the brain with the chemical that gets rid of short-term memory because it's much more important, yet you can't forget the trauma because that's indelibly imprinted and encoded as long-term memory. Because for survival, you want to remember something that was seriously threatening, but you don't need to remember that you were having a Snickers bar before it happened. So you can get rid of the trivial and incidental memories that you had that aren't particularly germane to survival in order to encode and capture and keep long-term memory. So what we're really talking about is saying, what is that chemical? Well, we know. Can we duplicate it? Yes. How do we administer it so that it can be done selectively and without knowledge of the subject that is being administered? Those are the tricky parts.
Hey, why do you think we forget dreams so quickly?
Why do I think what?
Why do you think we forget our dreams so quickly?
I'm wrong when they ask about that. I don't know. I mean, I know I've read explanations of it, why it is what it is that's happening and what part of the brain it takes place in that doesn't connect to meaningful memory. Unless it's a big dream, as Carl Jung called them, when your unconscious is really trying to communicate with your consciousness. And we have just a few of those in our lifetime. Every transition, maybe you have a big dream, and a dream of a house, and that's your psyche, and something important is going on, and you never forget that dream because it told you something. Really remember those. So apparently there's some crossover.
So to continue the parallel with early personal computers, is there a way you can get started on biohacking?
Yeah, let me get to the subject. This is all. Thank you. There's always somebody who wants you to talk about what you said you were going to talk about. Okay, there are. Let me approach the subject directly. That's the context in which we approach biohacking. Now, there are several kinds of things being done. Let's start with DIY bio. DIY bio is do-it-yourself bio, and it began to be a competitive endeavor across university campuses because in laboratories, on universities, you had the resources. And you had the supervision and the accountability to an academic structure environment that enabled young people, college students, to do serious scientific work and to be supervised in doing it. So DIY bio, it's a silly name, right? It's not good, DIY bio. It's too much to say. They wanted to say biohacking, but the word hacking had already been appropriated or misappropriated to mean not what I said it meant, this passionate interest in making things do something differently and cleverness and ingenuity. But as you know, a hacker is now somebody who stays up late in their bedroom cackling like Beavis or Butthead while they break into your bank account. And my experience, that's no more than half the guys I know. No more than it is some guys. So they called it DIY bio. Now, with supervision and with the laboratories and universities to do this, what in fact you have is it's like the old mainframe training. So this is one place you can do biohacking. And they have competitions to see who can come up with the most ingenious sorts of inventions. Now, what kinds of inventions? What are we talking about? We're talking about genetic engineering. We're talking about synthetic biology, which is the manufacture of organisms that do not exist in a natural form. We're talking about artificial life. We're talking about creating living organisms or splicing attributes and traits onto artificial or currently living organisms. We were talking about fluorescing cats and dogs and fish. This is something that's easy, striking, or putting the gene for fast growth from one salmon into another. Well, why is there screaming about that? Because it's going to hurt people? No, you eat the other salmon all the time. It's a gene. You might have an allergy to it, but for God's sake, you have allergies to all sorts of things that are spontaneously mutating in the environment all the time. It's really just an economic thing. The people whose ox is being gored don't want something out that's going to compete with them. But taking a gene for faster growth, putting in a salmon, growing the salmon twice as fast, and eating that salmon twice as often, that's an example of obviously just splicing the gene in. Now, in the university setting, one of the things they've done, for example, to show you the level of creativity that a group of young people can do when they're focused, they created a vaccine for the H. pylori virus. Now, the H. pylori virus, I think it's the eighth largest cause of death in the world. This is a serious virus. And they created, I mean, you want to take this in. Who used to do creation of vaccines? You think of it as on a large scale, on a corporate scale, large pharmaceutical companies or governments doing it. That's the level at which people think it is still exclusively being done. But what I'm saying is the skills, techniques, and abilities are migrating into a more private space. So one place to do it is academia. Now, I've also talked to biohackers who, as they will, we talked about Stallman in another session, Richard Stallman, you've got people who just scoff at that. If it's done in a university, said this one guy, Brian, he said, you know, then it's not hacking. Anybody can do it in a university. What I want to do is recreate all of that environment for us. Well, the cost of the equipment to do serious genetic engineering used to be hundreds of thousands of dollars, and it came down to tens of thousands of dollars, and now it's down to hundreds of dollars. For a couple of $1,000, you can get a good start in your garage doing the kind of work that we're talking about. But it is currently still time-consuming. There was an article last week in the Wall Street Journal about a gal who wanted to understand her own genome and for reasons to see if she carried a particular gene that her mother had and so on. You can get the millions of letters that encode your own particular genetic code, but then to do serious work with it still requires a village. I mean, it's not trivial to do it yet, but where the hacking is moving, and that's why I say late 70s, early 80s, these were people who worked on mainframes in universities. And if you ask somebody about a computer then, they would think of a glass enclosed, air-conditioned high priest space in which high priests in white robes moved and you couldn't get in, and the computers were this big. And that's why when J.C.R. Licklider, a psychologist who lent a great deal of wisdom and insight to the computing revolution, said, I foresee a time when there will be connections between all these computers and they will talk to each other. And he was talking to world-class scientists and Nobel Prize winners, and they were making rude gestures in the back of the room like, oh, shovel the shit. Because it was literally unthinkable that you could connect these huge mainframes to one another and they would talk and communicate with one another. And that's how crazy new emergent realities sound to you if you are still assimilated by and held by and owned by the prior technology. So while it was done exclusively by pharmaceutical companies and other corporations and government units, now it's done in universities, now it's done by groups of kids under the supervision of professors, and increasingly young people want and can get the tools to do it themselves. Well, you can't do it alone because you have to know too much. What you had to know about computing then was a lot. Now you can, as I say, download a script and execute and fire without even knowing the code. That's why real hackers have derision and contempt for script kiddies. So the day will come when you will be able to download modules that let you fluoresce your cat or your sister or whatever. Put the fluorescent gene on her toothbrush unknowingly in the middle of the night, and then the next day jump out, shine black light on her, and have her glow green, and just roar your little head off. This is a trivial example of something you can do if you want to make it fun for yourself. On a bigger scale, people are going to be able to do serious artificial life. You know, like Craig Venter, you know the kind of work he's doing with oil-eating bacteria. And he went out in the ocean off of California and he pulled up, I don't know, every 500 yards or so, he found thousands and thousands of organisms in each sample that nobody knew existed. And they now created an artificial organism. Well, it's not that difficult to create an artificial organism. It says, well, anybody can do that. You just take this part of the machinery and this part of the machinery and you put them together and you got an artificial organism that moves in response to light needs. Big deal. Well, it was a very big deal just a little while ago. So you need to connect with other people. This is what the computer revolution has done, but it has, in fact, already done it. The flow of information is accelerating faster and faster. You know that. You know that masters of a domain, true experts in any single subject, now can no longer master all of the material cranked out in journals in their own domain. There is just too much information moving too fast. So you need to collaborate. Most of you are probably trained in collaborative work teams and collaborative learning. Not too long ago, I did a school district in Northern Illinois. I talked to the teachers who said they were being graded poorly in developing kids who knew how to work collaboratively by the places they sent their graduates, Baxter and Abbott Labs and Motorola. And I said, what is collaborative learning in your understanding? And when they described it to me, I said, you know what we called that when I was in school? We called it cheating. Because I was told, do your own work. Don't look at anybody else's paper. Don't talk about your work. In other words, we really had drummed into us that you were an individual with a boundary, a monad, who had to function autonomously and regardless of who else was around you and what they might or might not be able to contribute to your project. The network created new social environments in which people discovered they were not monads with boundaries around them. They were, in fact, nodes in a network, and this simultaneously pushed power forward from the top down out to the node so that all of a sudden you had business seminars talking about every person must have the attributes of leadership today. Well, all these things, see, they're emergent properties, all a function of the technologies that have come into being. You didn't have to know that before, but qualities of leadership, initiative, and drive, and creativity, and seeing clearly, and saying what you see clearly, and so on, all became properties of the nodes and networks because power was now exercised in a network very differently than a top-down, hierarchical, domination and control sort of structure. That's why people start talking about flattening. Well, it's not that simple. It's flattening bigger branches but taller trees. We still have hierarchy, but we also have this flattening phenomenon. So what are young biohackers doing? They are working in collaboratory environments. And to assist them, people like Ted Knight at MIT have developed what he calls BioBricks. What is a BioBrick? It's just a downloadable program, a module, so you don't have to reinvent the wheel every time or, in fact, reinvent, a good example is the smell of pineapple or something like that. Why do you want to smell pineapple? Because one of the simple things that kids start to do is let's test for arsenic, let's test for zinc, let's test for substances in an organism. And what's the sign that that's present? Well, you need something easily detectable. The smell of something like pineapple, strong, fragrant, fills the room. Should you have to re-engineer the smell of pineapple from organic compounds every time you want to do that? No. So go look up BioBricks. BioBricks are a whole library that's growing apace even as we speak. Anybody can download the code for the biological compounds that make up a variety of different things. So you can be sure that when my friend Jonathan Marino is trying to ask people what we're doing behind the scenes in dark research and everybody's clammed up, it's a sign that they're doing it. And what are they doing? They're doing a lot more than pineapple. They're doing everything they can think of doing. I mean, some of the physicists I've talked to have DARPA contracts on zero-point energy field. This is a total aside. I did two talks on ufology because I'm interested in that. I've been interested in 30 years in UFO phenomena, the real stuff. Ever since an Air Force colonel told me that it was real. And that was back in the 70s. So I've used the positions I've been in to find out as best I can what's going on. I've talked to the better researchers in the field. And they use ridicule, just like they do in the biological stuff that Jonathan Marino found. A friend of mine who does deception at the NSA, he said there are three legs of deception. Illusion, misdirection, and ridicule. And when something is in plain sight, you hide it in plain sight by ridiculing the people who say that it's there. Pretty soon everybody walks around it. Pretty soon everybody doesn't even see it anymore. It's like the power grid, the lines of the electricity out there on pipes. Illusion, what you think you see is not what you see. Sleight of hand or misdirection. Look over here. And ridicule. So when something has gotten out, people say to me about all these various subjects, well, wouldn't it be leaked? If these things were real, wouldn't people know about them? Well, who the hell hasn't heard of a UFO? Everybody knows about it. But what you don't know is that you know. You know, but you don't know that you know. And that's the kicker. And that's what ridicule and the disintegration of the social agreement contract can do. You can know about it, but it's anomalous, and it's off here, and we don't talk about it, and it's out here. The way child abuse used to be. First doctors who tried to talk about the symptoms of beating children, literally people couldn't hear it. You couldn't talk about it. But they would come up to him, the doctor said, in the hallways. They wouldn't talk about it out here, where things are known, and known that they're known. But they'd say, you know, I saw a child like that in my office. Tell me again what you said the symptoms are. And gradually the paradigm drip, 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 finally changes. And as I said in another context, how do you go bankrupt? Gradually and suddenly. You know, gradually the data comes in, and then suddenly the paradigm flips and the model changes. This is what's coming in biological engineering. So what this young hacker said is, so what people think of is, I want attributes for intelligence. You can be sure that people will try to engineer what they believe are the best attributes. Why? Because we do all that now. How do we do it? We send our kids to the best schools, right? I mean, you do everything you can to secure an advantage. You give your kids good nutrition or help them with athletic sports or fitness. You want to give them physical and mental advantages. So you use the various tools and techniques that you have. Well, you can be sure that once those tools and techniques are widely available, they will be used. There's a period during which they're criminalized, and then they're not. Arnold Schwarzenegger signed a law, right, yesterday in California, you can have pot up to 1 ounce. Well, how much more can you smoke at a time? You know, smoke an ounce, get an ounce. Smoke an ounce, get an ounce. Just keep it in the car. Keep it somewhere else. It's no longer criminal. Stuff athletes take to make themselves better athletes. Right now it's criminal, or you get suspended. Isn't that silly? You can put everything else into your body that you can that makes you better, except these few things that make you really better. Well, sooner or later, we'll just take the asterisk off, because humankind will have those attributes if they want them. And that's just a trivial and obvious example. Take steroids. If you're willing to risk the tiniest balls on the planet and rage that blow to your heart when you're 42, go ahead and do it. You can be a very, very fast bike rider if you do that. But it's available, and it will become more and more available. But these are complex things, intelligence. They're kinds of intelligence. The brain is not the brain, it's the brain-body unit. There's an integration of hormones and cognitive structures and physiology that will make this very tricky going forward, but already we're making striking advances. A third area of biological hacking is being done by artists, who, for example, this one woman's been doing it for about 20 years. And she's got a hidden agenda. I'll give you one example. She created a whole community of trees that are all clones of one another. And she planted them in walkways, I think, in San Francisco. And her intention is that people walk into that grove of trees or that assembly of trees and have the literature explaining that these are all clones and have been created artificially in a laboratory. And yet they will look and they see, but they're not all identical. I thought a clone was identical. This is a way she wants to undermine the popular understanding of what is a clone. By creating a social environment in which you learn, and it undermines fundamentally what someone else is trying to teach you is so, in that case, about cloning. Same with, what's the name? What is it, 123 I'm Me or something, whatever this genetic engineering test is. It supposedly tells you whether you have these genes. What is it? 23andMe. 23andMe, right. And if you take a look at that, you know, it's pretty bogus. I mean, it doesn't tell you much meaningful information yet because it's so much more complex than you carry the genes. When is the gene switched on? When is it switched off? These kind of things are tricky. So she encourages people to do different things which will undermine the current ideology by the experience of what they think is an artistic or natural experience wandering in the trees and thinking about it in a way that I said, what you're doing is subversive. She said, that's right. All of her projects are meant to be subversive, but in a way that doesn't get her in trouble, lose her funding, stop her grants, or get her hurt or fired. Some of them are more extreme than that. Question?
What's her name?
I want to say Au. Damn it. I want to say Au, A-U-E-L, but it's not. Natalie is her name, but I'm trying to think of the last name. I'll find it in here. It's Natalie.
And you can go to DIY Bio. She provides experiments for people to do. Again, trying to get people to do hands-on stuff, like grow skin. She provides experiments to enable people to grow synthetic skin, except then you realize it's not synthetic. Again, teaching by doing in a way that is interesting. Okay, so those are the three things. You've got academic environments where it's being taught. You've got hackers who are trying to build smart tables that will give you the information as you do the experiment and connect wirelessly, simultaneously, as you're doing the work with other collaboratory people, just like hacker networks. And it's developing its own meritocracy, just as hacker subcultures develop meritocracy. You have to do all the homework yourself in a hacker subculture to show you've done everything possible to learn what you can. Then you take it to the board or the list and you say, I have a question. And if you're respectful and honor your mentors and your superiors, they will give you the answer because they recognize when you've done the work. But you can't go up and say, hey, I want a flame so-and-so in India. How do I do that? And they just press destroy button. So young people, academic environments, subversive sociological and artistic communities all are now beginning to migrate the artificial manipulation of biological structures into the mainstream. Because of the computer revolution, the knowledge is disseminated faster and faster, more and more. Pretty soon you're going to have more and more people doing it. And you will have kits like my hacker, Alter Genie kits, or the like. You will be able to make major changes rather than just minor tweaks and do more than just fluoresce yourself cutely. So you don't have to listen to me and listen to Bill Gates. He said go into biology, not computing. That's the frontier of the new humanity. We will bootstrap ourselves from the inside out this time, recreate our identity based on the kind of attributes we want. And this has a profound effect on people. One of my favorite experiments that someone did is they developed, it's not developing the sensory stuff, it's getting it connected with your brain through a channel or pathway that your brain can understand as information that it can use. That's the tricky part. So what they had was a series of magnets that went down the spine of a guy. And they managed to connect it to his brain in such a way that, you know how birds do it, they use the magnetic field to tell where they are. The guy could do it. Pretty soon he was riding his bike, he said, I always knew where true home was. He had no idea, he said, that paths wandered like this, that roads wandered so much, because he always knew when he was off center. He always knew how to go home. And it was like at the back of his brain, it was like plugged in here, and he had a sixth sense, literally, of where he was geospatially, just like you do now with GPS, which not long ago we didn't have. I said it was a loss to never get lost again. It was going to eliminate a whole possibility of narrative structure for literature. Always to know where you are. It's a whole different world. You're inside and watching yourself inside. Well, he could move around like this. And he always knew where he was, and he developed this sixth sense, and he internalized it, and he dreamed about it, and he felt it. And when after 6 months they took it off, he felt profound grief. He felt like he had lost his sight, for example, or his hearing, because he had added a new ability to navigate in the world biologically by an implant. And of course, that's the other way neuroscience is going to do it, through implants. Again, a few years ago they were talking about maybe we can do implants, and now we're doing implants. And now we're doing beanies, which can wirelessly do things to the brain that before required an invasive implant and be able to do it at a distance. And so what's going to happen when we can weaponize all this stuff? Will we weaponize it? Well, it's where it starts and it's where it always ends. So you know, there are at least six different ways that I know of putting a voice in somebody's head.
Are there venture capitalists now around the country for DIY?
I don't know. That's it. One of my teachers used to say, that's a very good question. You check that out over the weekend and bring in the paper on Monday morning on that subject. Make a report to the class. One would guess. one would guess. I mean, here and in Madison, you know, that biological research is our thing. We missed one revolution. We're trying very hard not to miss another. So you can put a voice in somebody's head. There are different ways of doing it. It changes how you think about the world. When Koresh at Waco says, I began hearing the voice of God, well, was he schizophrenic or was the FBI just screwing with him? Why did it develop? According to John Alexander, I talked to, he does non-lethal weapons. Well, they may not be lethal unless you use them to be lethal, but they do all sorts of weird stuff, like make people vomit and experience pain. And that was just non-lethal. He said the reason we developed that was because if we had somebody undercover inside, and they were inside a terrorist nest or whatever, and their cover was blown, you couldn't call them on a cell phone. You know, you had to find a way, if it's you, and you've got people around you, and you want to target just that person, you can put a voice right directly in his cranium that only he can hear, and then no one else can hear it. And this is going to be coming, we're not sure how it's going to play out, marketing. You know, I saw a test where you walk past the Coke machine, and just here, not here, not here, just here, you hear pop, top, glub, 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 drink me, drink me, drink me. And you walk out and you say, am I crazy? Drink me, come on, drink me. And then you realize you're the only one hearing it. Well, that's been a definition of insanity for a long time, right? You're the only one hearing it. But then Nietzsche said, people were thought dancing. People were thought crazy by those. People who were dancing were thought to be crazy by those who couldn't hear music. That's what he said. So that's a paradigm change. Questions about some of this? I guess we're done. Questions?
What are your thoughts on, aside from genetics and splicing manipulation, what about technological augmentation?
Uh-huh.
So, giant robotic kind of hard drive in the head, laser sight on the how far away do you think that kind of tech is from being?
Doing it easily and in a way that's spliceable to us in a seamless way, when something would come out for a computer, it would be a standalone appliance or device, and suddenly Microsoft has bought it, killed the owner, or whatever, and it's integrated into your new laptop, and it's just a feature. Now, so you're saying, when will those become features? We have heads-up displays, right? And we know that we can do some identification of people through iris examination. So if I have something on my glass, it's not intrusive, and it gets an identification of you by doing a facial scan or an iris scan, and then it sends that wirelessly to a database where those are stored, and then a little voice whispers in my ear, his name is John, he has $32,000 in the bank, he's interested in wheat checks, chicks, and whatever. In other words, the kind of information that every time you click like on another site these days, all that is a marketer's dream. That's all that is for, collecting the information from all over the web and finding out what you and your friends and your friends' friends like. And we'll buy, and they've got, Levi's Jeans has 100,000 names just from 100,000 people who clicked like Levi's. That's a dream. And people do it voluntarily, and you don't have to spend money on phone calls. So anyway, the voice will tell me about you, and why would I carry a book? Why would I carry a PDA when I can wirelessly access a database that gives me that kind of information? Can imagine a doctor coming in. Can imagine any number of environments in which that would be useful. That's almost there. It's just whether it's effective, whether it's cost effective. We don't know yet. We know that we're doing implants and there are unexpected consequences, like some of the implants are for Tourette's, for example. And yet they found, but it also does this. They found out it has a profound effect on depression. And they didn't know that part of the brain. Well, now they're pinpointing what exact cluster of cells, small, in the brain will affect this or that thing and deliver a pinpoint strike to it instead of like chemotherapy, which is carpet bombing the whole brain with a flood of chemicals in the body. It's going to look as primitive as cutting, bleeding, bleaching did before. So when you say how close are we, I have no idea because I don't know when these things are going to pop. And I don't know when they're going to be let out of in the marketplace. I don't know. It's safe to say all within a reasonable period of time. I don't know.
Can you give some specific examples of biohacking that's happening today? For example, I remember 2 weeks or months ago they announced the first totally synthetic organism. But I wonder if they're more prosaic or smaller scale efforts that are producing after
their biohacking. Well, gosh, I mean, you know, off the top of my head, for some reason I'm going white, but there are numerous medical
techniques that when the ability to reproduce those easily and cheaply and in the home is replicated, will just simply come out of the realm of medicine and into the realm of hacking, because then people can do them themselves. Yeah, creating a synthetic organism is tricky, it was good for the headlines. But the kinds of research breakthroughs that are being achieved over and over and over again, once the knowledge of what it is that requires is made more widely available and people can implement it more easily and cheaply in groups. A good example is the attempt to develop biological weapons. It's not difficult to create a pathogen that will kill a lot of people. What it's difficult to do is create a pathogen that will only kill so many people. So, I mean, you probably heard the story. The Israelis wanted one that would kill just Arabs and made the unfortunate discovery that Jews and Arabs are so similar to one another genetically, a Semitic cousin, that they can't kill all the Arabs without killing all the Jews. Some think that would be the solution to the Middle East. One way or another, but probably not the optimal solution. So tweaking it, getting it right, that's, I think, why we haven't had any of these major biological attacks on us. But we've done them. You know, we've attacked the pork population, pigs, in Cuba with overflights. We know that. There are lots of ways that if you can learn how to infect pork, you know, you got to be crazy, a bad guy hacker, a black hat hacker, to go kill pigs, right, for no reason. So to find one that's creative and meets the hacker ethos, which is invade the system but do no harm, that's the tricky part.
Is
that
mechanism that eats control, is that actually a
carrier,
or is that some sort of...
Is what?
Organism that metabolizes control.
Yeah, I don't know. I believe so. I believe it was found rather than made. As I say, that distinction is going to increasingly be difficult.
If anybody wants a card and want to talk about this, check out the website, take one. These are the two most recent books. I'll sell them to you, but it's all on the website for you. Thank you for your attention. Oh, that's just a postcard with the cover of my book because it's so cute.
Oh, okay.